Welcome back to Minds Matter, a podcast sponsored by the Monash Center for Consciousness and Contemplative Studies. I'm Ava.
And I'm Beth. And on Minds Matter, we explore research from neuroscience to psychology whilst occasionally talking through our own personal experiences.
This week on the podcast, I spoke to Dr. Pauline Ho, who is currently a visiting assistant professor at Reed College. And most of her research looks at identity and identification across the lifespan. In this episode, we talk about a recent qualitative paper that she came out with, examining three different kind of paths to identity, specifically in African-American college students. I think this was a really interesting kind of new look at identity and this type of research that often on the podcast we talk about with more quantitative research and terms. But I think this episode really brings to light and makes shine the reason why we might still want to do this more qualitative research. And I hope this kind of motivates everyone to think a little bit more deeply about the ways that they identify, the groups that are important to them, and what that might mean for their own kind of meaning making of their life and their life story.
My name is Pauline, and I recently completed my PhD in educational psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison this past May. Right now, I'm a visiting assistant professor in developmental psychology at Reed College in Portland. I am a developmental psychologist and an identity researcher. So my work focuses on understanding when, why, and how identity develops inside the individual, really trying to identify aspects that are both common and unique across different identity domains, and try to map the connections between identity and other life experience in adolescence. My research so far mainly focused on ethnic racial identity and professional or career identity developments, which are the two key tasks of adolescence and young adulthood.
How did you first become interested in studying these different identities and identity development?
My interest in studying identity developments stem from my personal experience of navigating my own identity. I was a first-generation college student born in Vietnam. I was raised in a Chinese culture, came to the United States when I was 12, and now I'm a naturalized U.S. citizen. So when I grow up, I often feel like I don't really fully belong to any of the group that I mentioned. And this sense of like not fitting into any culture really bring the question like who I am and what I want to do in the future, especially in the Asian culture. I'm that kind of person who always care about what other people think and what other people want me to do. And I never really asked myself what exactly I want to do. And then growing up in California, like LA, which is very diverse, I don't really think about ethnic and racial identity that much either. So when I came to my PhD institution, Wisconsin-Madison, as a predominantly white institution, so the identity crisis really hit me hard, not just the ethnic and racial part, but also the PhD part about what you want to do. This personal journey led me to focus on ethnic and racial identity for my master thesis because I want to explore how artists from minority background come to understand and navigate their identity in such a complex society. And then I also looked into the theories of ethnic and racial identity, and I found like my experience so unique that none of the theory really explain that. So I want to figure out, is there an explanation to my experience? So that would get me interested in my master thesis.
Okay, so you talked about looking to kind of understand your own identity, and the framework that you've used in your research and that guides your overall research is integrating developmental science and personality psychology. You talk about this idea of developmental contextualism and narrative identity. Can you talk about these two frameworks and how they kind of inform your work and how they're useful and just what they are for us?
Yeah, so basically my main interest is like how identity evolves over time. So really dig into the developmental part. So central to my research is developmental contextualism, which basically emphasizes that developments occur through continuous and reciprocal interactions between the developing individual and their changing context. So both the individual and the context are changing over time, and their interaction also changes over time. So that interactive nature is not really captured in much of the research, like especially in identity right now. And three key principles of this framework is that the individual are active agents of their own developments. which means every individual has a pretty unique developmental process. And then development is embedded in context, and the context is multi-layered. So a lot of research really just pick one context and ask, like, how does context affect identity? Instead, I really want to see how this identity is formed based on all the layer context around this individual. And then this framework also suggests that development is a lifelong process. So we need to consider what happened before in order to understand what happened now. So that really led me to doing longitudinal work in my qualitative research rather than just like doing a snap start of like getting data and analyze what's happening now. I really focus on narrative identity because that focus on how the individual makes sense of their life by constructing their own personal story. So this framework allowed me to study identity as an active meaning-making process where people organize life experience into coherent narrative that reflect who they are at the moment and who they want to become in the future. Through analyze the story people tell, I can explore how this narrative shape and reflect their current identity rather than just going with the current framework and measure in the literature, like how much the individual has explored and commits. From there, we say, this person is at this particular stage. I want to give the room and the opportunity for the individual to tell me what is their identity right now. So both of these frameworks together really helped me to understand identity developments as a fluid and ongoing process in which the individual is actively constructing their identity. Even in the research process of interviewing with me, they are making meaning at that moment as well. And this framework also highlights the importance of using change-sensitive and diversity-sensitive methods to track identity over time. So that is really account for like diversity in terms of like cultural, social, contextual differences, and how different aspects of identity could change over time rather than researchers say, this is what should be changing, right? I think this can give me a more comprehensive view of identity developments and reflect the diversity of human experience and recognize the dynamic nature of identity.
That's really interesting because in some of the more quantitative classic social psychology background, often identity is kind of a moderator variable that might play into some of the dynamics that people are studying, like how strongly you might be influenced by a discriminatory either statement or behavior that might be influenced by how strongly you're identifying. But identifying with a group is measured on like a 1 to 5 scale. That's very simple. That's just like, how strongly do you identify with this group, or those overlapping circle type diagrams? Mm-hmm. Obviously, all of these identities are so much more complicated than that. So it feels like it makes a lot of sense that we need more in-depth studies of those things. When you talked about context, what exactly is a context? What counts as a context?
Yeah, so this is also a part of my research is I really give the opportunity for the participant to tell me what context matter to them. So the context in my research can range from the family settings, what happened inside the family, the neighborhood, or the social changes, social movement that's happening in the society, or social media. So it's really up to the participant to tell me what context matter to them. And then when I analyze the data, some context that I consider is the context of the individual, like their background, their developmental history, and how that can give me a lens to understanding what is going on right now to the participants.
Maybe we can talk about your 2024 paper where you kind of put these things to work, where you look at this lifespan model of ethnic and racial development, which considers these contextual, individual, and historical factors. Could you talk a little bit about this lifespan model before we get into the findings that you had in this study?
When I conducted research, which I started in 2019, and then not published until now, and then I kind of redo the study because when I first started, it's like the sample size too small, then the journal rejected, and then I decided I'm going to redo the study again. So when I start the study, the lifespan model haven't been published yet. So it's really exciting to see that other scholars are moving toward the same trend I'm seeing right now. So I think basically what the lifespan model is suggesting that is we need to take a lifespan approach to identity developments. Right now, a lot of researchers focus on a particular developmental period and say this is what happened in this particular period without considering what happened before and what could happen later. And they pick out one particular aspect of identity and say this is something that we want to explore. However, the lifespan approach really consider that the individual and other developmental aspects of the individual, for example, cognitive ability, their personality, and they suggest that once the individual was born, they somehow interact with the race and ethnicity in a way, and then that really set the foundation of their trajectory. And it really outlined the 5 different dimensions of ethnic racial identity to make a more comprehensive view of ethnic racial identity. And they suggest all the different changes that could happen and how the individual racial ethnic identity development is really influenced by life experience and the individual developmental trajectory as an individual. So over time, as the individual gain more cognitive skill and understanding of their context, of their background, they might respond to the life experience very differently, which lead to a very different outcome in terms of their identity dimensions. It's like a big move to taking a lifespan perspective and considering not just at the moment what is happening and what are we seeing, rather than how things have changed from the beginning to the end. So the first part of this study, I interviewed African Americans and Hispanic Americans, but the sample size is pretty small. I think it's only like 18 people and with 2 different ethnic groups. So then I decided I'm going to redo this. So with that study, I only focused on African Americans. I interviewed 20 African American college students at different age group, and I asked them to tell me pretty much their whole journey of how they make sense and how they come to understand who they are in terms of race and ethnicity. And the way that I asked them is think about the key moments that really make a big change to your understanding of your racial and ethnic identity. So they really identify a list of experiences that can happen anywhere from childhood, adolescence, or while in college. Then I try to map out what are the changes that happen within each of the periods and how the individual is moving toward a particular trajectory. So what I found is that there are 3 identity pathways, what I call them. So one of the pathways, I call them consolidating. So this other individual, they were born in an environment with a lot of people who identify the same. So also identify as Black. They live in a safe zone where a lot of people look like them. As a result of this, they have a very strong and solid understanding of what it means to be Black. And that understanding early on really set the foundation for whatever happened after. So because the early understanding is so strong, it affects how they interpret the future experience. Like when they go to high school, when they go to college, the way they interpret that is really about how the environment is interpreting my identity, not how I should identify my identity. And then they come up with ways to manage that. So how should I cope with discriminations? How should I be more active to talk about my group? Their identity hasn't changed. It's just consolidating their early understanding, but they are coming up with ways to think about what I can do. And then they start to think about intersectionality. So they start to think about how my race and ethnic identity intersect with my gender. What is my position as a Black woman in this society? And then I also have individuals who fall into another track called the cumulative track. So these are the individuals who continuously and gradually learning about their identity over time. So they can come from a very different background, like they live in a diverse or predominant white or predominant Black. However, their skin color is what makes things different. Because of their skin color, the topic of race and ethnicity is not a major topic when they're growing up. So they're really approaching this topic as something very academic, for example. So this is a concept that I want to understand rather than something that is emotionally attached to me, that define me. So over time, as they learn more about it through classes, through conversation with other people, they develop a more coherent understanding of what it means to be Black. However, that doesn't really affect how they feel as an individual. And then I have the third group, which I call transformative. Transformative are those who like have a big change in their identity trajectory. So these are the individuals who usually grew up in a predominant white environment. They have dark skin color. So it's very obvious since as a kid that their identity is different from everyone around them. So they usually are the only person of color in their community. So because of that, they usually encounter a lot of like the negative experience, like discriminations, microaggressions, as a result, they really see the identity as something negative. They don't want to be Black. And then when they start coming to college or in around high school senior year, something happened that really changed their attitude toward the identity. So going from negative to very positive. Right now, I really want to learn about my identity. I feel so proud about it, and I want to be more active about it. This kind of incident can range from discriminations or a conversation with a family member, or even I have one participant who talked about being accused, actually going to court just because of her race. And then that really changed how she viewed her race and her connection with the community as well. So overall, there are three different pathways suggesting that even though they all identify as African-Americans, they all have different approach to their identity, and they are taking different learning lessons from their life experience.
So in the transformative versus the cumulative group, you mentioned that skin color played a really important role. Was it an objective facet of skin color? So darker skinned people were having these experiences versus lighter skinned people were more likely to just not think as much about their race?
I think it's an interaction of the skin color and the environment around them. I have participants who have dark skin color in the cumulative track. However, the environment around them is very neutral to the issue of race and ethnicity. So that topic of race and ethnicity and being different still doesn't come up in the cumulative track, even if their skin color is dark. But the majority of the participants in the cumulative track has light skin color. So that's also what reason why they never really think about it.
That's really interesting. And I feel like it maybe it's also my bias as like a mixed person. And I know that not all light-skinned people are mixed, but that it feels like a lot of the times, and this is maybe just a full-on bias, but that like a lot of the times people who are really advocating for the liberation of their group and are talking about race a lot tend to be people who feel like they're not able to be as included in that racial minority identity. As you were saying, like these in-between identities make people get really freaked out about their identities and like force them to think about them.
So related to the first point that you mentioned, the people who tend to be more active about their racial ethnic identity or their group is those who don't see themselves as belong to that group as much. So I actually see this in all three of my group. Yeah, so if we're just looking at how active this person is in terms of their race and ethnicity, their participation in the group, and how much they advocate for that group, it's not really telling us their feeling toward this group, how much they understand about this group. When you actually look at how things has developed over time, the three groups have very different trajectory, different feeling. So for example, for the consolidating pathway, the participant are still very active to share their voice in predominantly white institutions. They see it as a way to share correct information because their early understanding is so strong and so solid that they think they need to be spreading correct information and understanding across people. And as they encounter discrimination and those things, similar experience, they really see it, I need to come up with a way to cope with that and to support my peer to cope with that. So the way they're thinking about it and interpret them is very different from someone. I also see a certain level of activism in my cumulative track. However, for them, they are advocating for equality and diversity from a more academic aspect. This is something that we should be doing as a human being. And then for the transformative track, they feel guilt for feeling negative about my identity early on. So what I need to do now to pay for that in a way is to be much more active and really dig more. So the reasoning behind that is very different.
That's really interesting. Was there anyone in your sample who felt still negatively about their identity, especially, I guess, racial identity?
I would say no. I think with qualitative research, everyone self-selected to this study. And because the study is conducted as a predominantly white institution, so there's a tendency that people who want to talk about their race and ethnicity are not like still in the process of figuring out, but are really excited about the topic in a way. So I think there is a self-selection bias there in terms of the sample. However, across all three pathways, all the participants mainly from the cumulative and transformative, really express an interest in learning more and acknowledge that they still learning and exploring.
That makes sense. I was going to ask if there were some people who had never really thought about these questions, but it sounds like if they were self-selecting, they were probably excited to get to talk to someone.
Yeah,
about.
I would say it will be really interesting to do a study where people who don't think about this topic. And the challenge with that is how to get them to participate.
Yeah. I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about how you analyze the data. How do you think about your own positionality?
So, yeah, the data analysis process is really, really took a lot of time because I think we did a total of 4 steps to code the data. Just even with transcribing the data, my intern and I were transcribing the data. We also write down like memos and notes what we see in the interview. And from there, really think about how my personal background can impact the way that I'm interpreting this participant experience. So writing memo, and we analyze that later. But because in the interview, I asked them to recall experience from different time point, in order to map out the developmental change over time, the first thing is to color code all the data. So that is really telling me this is something happened in childhood, this is something happened in adolescence. And then from there, we also can see when those kind of key moments often like tend to happen, which all of them tend to happen like in high school sometime, but childhood is also a time that things happen. So there definitely need to be more research on identity in childhood. There hasn't been a lot of focus on that. So the first step is to analyze the data based on timing. The second step is through text level coding and memory level coding. So for the text level coding, we're really going through the data and see what are the topics they are talking about. So for example, we code for things like the specific factor that matter in this experience, the specific attitude this person is having toward their racial and ethnic identity at this moment, the meanings of the identity to this participant right now. And then we go back to the data once again and really code it by the memories. So this is a memory where they talk about discriminations. This is a memory where they talk about interaction with other people from a different ethnic background, for example. So we want to see what kind of story they are telling and whether or not that matters as well. And then after that, we go back the data again and to do another level of analysis called change over time. So in this one, we really pull up 2 time points, the first story from childhood and the second story. We see what kind of change is happening here. Is that what we call incremental change, or is that a transformative change, or there's no change? Is the change happening in a certain aspect of the identity or not? We're trying to capture as much as possible through our data set. And at each level, at each of the steps, we also conduct peer review and discussions and really think about how our interpretation of the data and our identity can affect our coding. So it's a very lengthy process. In my research team, because I identify as an Asian American, I don't have a lot of knowledge about African Americans. I have someone from an African American's background, so they can give some information on the data. Also, my advisor is someone who identifies as white, so he also can give some insight into that. And then I also have someone who identifies as Asian, but from a different background from me, so that they also can provide some insight into differences in interpretations and how our personal background may affect that. But the good thing is after training, we have a really high reliability, suggesting that we try our best to limit our bias in our coding.
So the themes that you picked out, you're not looking to confirm any hypotheses, right? They just come out of the data that you have.
Yeah, everything is very inductive. When I begin the study, I don't have a specific ethnic racial identity theory in mind. I just want the participant to tell me how things have changed and whether or not there is a pattern there.
From there, is it typical to build theory based off of that? Because it feels like those 3 different pathways feel very plausible, but also like they could be tested in other ways and with maybe more quantitative methods.
One way to do with qualitative research is we start out with inductive, like whatever the data tell us. And then from there, we can start to see if this pattern still applies to different ethnic group, maybe. And then we also can see if this is something we can convert into a quantitative scale. And if we want to develop a theory based on that, we need much more data to really tell us how things are interacting to form those fabway.
So you mentioned testing this on other ethnic groups. I'm wondering if you've done that, if you have hints of that, and also if you're willing to share just your personal experience as someone who got into this field because they're interested in understanding their own identity from the Asian perspective. Do you feel like this kind of resonated with you as well?
Yeah, so I'm actually starting to collect data. I just submitted my IRB to conduct a study focused on Hispanic Americans and Asian Americans. So I have some interview with Hispanic Americans like in the first original study, but somehow all of them fall into the cumulative track. That is a question I want to explore further, whether the other two track is still applicable for Hispanic Americans. For the Asian American, I do have some data from another project that speak to like key moments or key experience that lead to a change to your identity. And interestingly, so far I can see a consolidating and a cumulative track, but I don't see any participant based on that data set to fall into a transformative track yet. And I don't know, because that study is conducted during the COVID-19 period. So maybe the COVID-19 and what happened during the COVID-19 can be a transformative experience for some. So I want to explore that with my current study this year right now to get more data and see if all the green pathways still apply for Asian Americans. I'm also in the process of doing a quantitative scale to measure the green pathway. I have all the scale developed and all the items. I just need to test them. Right now, I'm trying to test them on African Americans because I still don't have data on other ethnic groups. However, next year, I will be testing them or modify them for other ethnic groups as well. And then in terms of my personal experience, I see myself falling into a transformative track. However, the interesting thing about this, which I also mentioned in my article, is none of the pathways are fixed or permanent. So once you are a transformative, you're not transformative forever. As you encounter new life experience, you may be moving to a new pathway. So for example, for me, if I were to conduct this interview, someone to conduct this interview with me like 2 years ago, I will be in a transformative track because the experience I recall will be going to grad school and being in a predominant white institution for the first time. And that completely shifts everything related to my identity and how I think about it. If someone were to interview me now, I would still tell them I see my track as cumulative because starting from that point, I'm starting to get more and more understanding about my own understanding, which also impact how I interpret that transition of going to a predominant white. So that no longer is like a transformative, rather I would explain in a way like a turning point for me, but not like from negative to positive, just like from no interest to some interest and to more interest now. So the more life experience you encounter, the way you explain what happened to you can be very different. So people can be moving around different pathway all the time.
That's really interesting. I wanted to ask about how these things shift, especially as personal narratives. In terms of changing pathways, do you think it's more likely someone might change from one pathway to another? Could you go from cumulative to transformative? Because it feels like cumulative is you're already kind of thinking about it a lot and presumably in a more positive way.
Yeah, I can see someone going from cumulative to transformative, but the transformative piece is not just the attitude aspect anymore. Rather, it's like, how important is this identity to me? For the cumulative track right now, based on the data, what I can tell is they really are taking an approach to race and ethnicity. So they just learning it as a concept or as a part of me. And I want to know more about it. However, if something happened to them that is very meaningful or from someone who really close to them, something that they never expect will happen to them, but happened to them now. And race and ethnicity can be something super, super important to them now. And they might have a very different attitude toward it. So that can make them into a transformative track, going from neutral to maybe positive or negative.
I see. And the consolidation track, that's something that feels like it's kind of rooted in your childhood. Is that something that you think could change as well?
I suspect there could be change in that pathway as well. So for example, if someone has very strong and solid understanding early on from their family, however, when they grow up, going to college, something happened from the same age, from those who they received those messages. For example, if they learn mainly from their parents, and then later on, their parents are sharing a different message about it, or something happened to their parents that their parents changed the way they think about race and ethnicity, which can also really impact the child, the way the individual think about it now. So I think for that track, it could be something not happening directly to the participant, but happening to the people who have a really significant impact on them.
So you mentioned some other identities that are not related to race and ethnicity. How do you feel like this might fit in with other identities that formed later but still central to people's lives? If you're LGBTQ, that's not typically something that you're, well, some people are, but that you're kind of like raised in a community where people have that same identity, and it seems like it can come from just anywhere. So do you feel like these pathways might apply similarly?
Yeah. So I think one thing about the pathway is really being sensitive to the kind of change that happened to the individual over time. So it's not really the content of the change and what caused the change can be very unique to the particular identity or a particular group. However, I think the pathway still applies to a lot of different identity. For example, disability identity. Something can happen and the individual can right now have a disability, and that can be a very important aspect of the identity now. So that will be the beginning of the identity. That will be the initial understanding, the initial experience they have with that identity. And the pathway is really suggesting to compare the initial understanding to what happened later on, to put them into the pathway rather than what exactly happened and where to get that information.
So in this research, you talked about how adolescence was a really important period, but you're interested in the lifespan as a whole. So are there kind of particular developmental stages where identity formation is really crucial? And I guess speaking of these other types of identities, like maybe if someone has a disability later on in life, does it really depend on the type of identity that we're talking about? Or are there really stages where things become important as well? And maybe if you're very rooted in, like, I don't know if you know self-affirmation theory, that's like a social psych thing. Mm-hmm. But if you're like very rooted in your ethnic identity, can that help you later on deal with some other types of identities that you may develop later on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. So traditionally, researcher has been thinking that adolescence is a key time for our identity developments. That's mainly because during this period, the adolescent is going through a lot of significant changes like cognitive, emotional, or social relationship changes. And they are exposed to much more variety of contexts like peer, work, school. And they really try to figure out where I fit in and what is my interest and who I want to be. So this is like the prime time for studying identity. And that is a salient issue for all adolescents. However, I do think that there are certain identities that can come later on. It's even possible that it comes very early on in childhood and then the adolescent never think about it in their adolescence, and something happened and they start to think about it again in midlife. I think this is one of the limitations of the current identity research, is so many researchers only focus on adolescents. And I need to admit that one reason I focus on adolescents also because the convenience of college student sample. Because as a grad student, you don't have the funding, you don't have the resources to reach the people, all those things. So this is also why a lot of research has been done on college student and high school student. So I think I'm interested in all the life stages because I think the individual is evolving every single day. So things can change very differently on a daily basis, and they can acquire a new identity. For example, when you get into a romantic relationship, when you get into marriage, when you think about being a mom, for example. So all those identities come at a very different time point. So it's not really attached to that age anymore as the society is changing right now. So age is, I think pretty soon age is no longer the key aspect here. So it's what happen to make this person think about this identity is maybe the question.
Yeah, yeah. That would be so interesting to explore motherhood. I feel like that's, well, maybe I just don't know the identities research, but I feel like that's very underexplored. Yeah, and it's such an important identity.
As I'm getting to my 30, I really start to get more interested in this topic.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Yeah, because a lot of people around, we start to become a mom, and then my family members start asking me about marriage. So I was like really start thinking about this and what exactly it is to be a mom.
Yeah. That's, I mean, yeah, if this is your research field already, so I'll go out and interview a bunch of moms. I would love to do that. Mm-hmm. That's super interesting. So based on your answer to this question, in your sample, you were interviewing students who were at UW-Madison. So this is a predominantly white institution.
Yeah.
And also a very specific sample of Black college students going to this particular institution. How do you feel that this influenced what you were seeing in your data? And do you think if you looked at a sample of maybe people who just worked, even the same age group, but just went to work after high school, do you feel like that would have changed how frequently you were seeing the different pathways? Do you think it could have changed the pathways at all? But I guess, like, how do you see that influencing your findings?
So doing the interview at a predominantly white institution with all the students coming from that institution. So one thing that I find is the impact of being at a predominantly white is not universal to all my participants. So what really decide what kind of impact this place have on the individual is what happened before college. So if the participants have been living in a predominantly white community for their whole lives, coming to UW-Madison may not have any impact on them. Actually, I have participants who have that experience, and the way they describe to me is UW-Madison is the most diverse place ever. And then because of this diversity, I'm really interested in learning about who I am. So it still increased the awareness about this topic in them. However, the reasoning is very different. And it's also because they haven't really get a lot of information about their race and ethnicity before. So when they come to UW-Madison, which is also a college environment, they really see it as an opportunity for them to take the initiative to learn about their identity. Yeah. So I think this also is very different from a lot of research right now focusing on predominantly white college institutions. It's that they all suggest that this institution will have an impact on the individual if they identify as Black or a minority. However, it's really depend on what happened before to this individual and what this individual bring with them to this environment. And that interactions decide whether or not this context is going to matter or not. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. So from an educational psych background, do you see this influencing educational practices or how educators are thinking about their students and helping them kind of talk about their identities, if you see that as an important thing for educators to be doing at all? Or are there kind of other applications that you hope to see in this research?
Yeah. So I see this research really can have a lot of implications for educational practice. I think a lot of the program, especially in like predominantly white college campus right now, really focusing on the developing program that can help students navigate with microaggressions, develop sense of belonging. So they focus like, oh, this context can cause challenge to the individual, and we need to find way to help the individual navigate this context. However, my research suggests really shifting the focus also to the individual. So the support that we need to provide can need to be very unique to the individual developmental trajectory. So what are the challenges? How they interpret this new experience? And from there, we can see what kind of support is most helpful for this particular individual. So it's really kind of shift our focus of what we can do as an educator or as administrator in a college campus to really provide individualized support, not individualized to the individual, maybe individualized to the current pathway that the individual's in. It also can impact the way we develop programs to increase the development of racial and ethnic identity. So even though we are sharing the same information about racial and ethnic identity, all the participants in the program can take it very differently. So in addition to having those information, maybe we can have more staff working with the student try to understand where they come from, how they are making sense of this information, and what they get from this information. So it's really focusing on that meaning-making process within the individual rather than just like, oh, they need this information and I provide it to them. And I think this will be helpful.
So in this episode, we talked a lot about one key paper that Pauline recently published that looked at these three pathways to identification. Obviously, this was done with African-American participants. Neither Beth or I are African-American, but Pauline did talk about looking at this model with other groups, both racial groups, but also other types of identities. So I thought that we could think a little bit more about these three pathways and whether we feel like they resonate with us about any type of identity that we have, and also whether we feel like they impact us to kind of act in the world in different ways. One of the things that I found really interesting about this conversation was Pauline discussing collective action and how a lot of and desires to engage in collective action, and the idea that the participants, regardless of the pathway that they identified with, did mention wanting to engage in collective action, but the reasons for which they did that was very different. So I don't know, Beth, you have a lot of identities. We all have a lot of identities. I was thinking about your identity as an Australian person because I think those are the types of identities that we don't tend to think about until we are away from them, until it becomes something that is not an afterthought, but like the most important quality that someone sees in you when they meet you, which I'm assuming happened to you once you left Australia.
Yeah, I think because I'm like a white Australian woman, I have an identity that is a very privileged one. Like, you know, it's like in the media and everything, like that's a person that is always like, oh, we love those women and blah, blah. So I just want to say that I know that my identity is one that is taken in with open arms and how lucky that is. So I feel like I've never been these experiences of having it challenged or something. Like, you know, some of my friends are talking about trying to get other places and visas and stuff. And I was like, wow, I've never had to think about that. Like, if you have an Australian passport, you can just go wherever you want. And so can't begin to imagine how any of that would feel. So I suppose given everyone loves like Australians, when I went overseas, I felt very close to that.
I mean, it was allowed. That's also allowed. Identities don't have to be negative. And I think that was something that is interesting about Pauline's approach, is this idea of meaning making from our identities. And it could be that you just don't really think about it that much. And that's okay too. But I think it's interesting at which points our identities and which facets of our identities become really central to us engaging in the world and trying to figure out our place. And I would imagine that being Australian and blonde and like fitting the kind of Australian stereotype was something that at least maybe tacitly you knew.
Yeah. And I remember when I came home and I was like, oh my God, like why aren't I getting special treatment?
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because it's like, you know, people really love Australians. It's crazy. And but when you're here, we're all Australians. So it's like,
yeah, that's true. Because I guess in the US, you would open your mouth and be like, oh my God, where are you from?
Yeah. And like, oh, your accent. And, you know, you can get away with more because you can just say, oh, it's just an Australian thing. Can't do that here.
Oh my God, did you say that for things that were not really an Australian thing?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I feel like when you visit, you'll be like, wait, these were Beth things. Like,
oh my God, wow, I've never even considered that.
Yeah, I've got friends visiting for the first time from the US in January, and I'm going to be exposed.
Yeah, you're going to be exposed. Oh my gosh. Wow. Okay. So this identity has served you in ways that were explicitly to your advantage.
Yes. I'll be like, wait, Australians aren't like a chaotic mess. That's a Beth thing.
That's really interesting. Do you feel like you're a prototypical Australian?
I don't know. Maybe not.
I don't know really what my stereotype of Australians was until we met. But now I feel that it might just be you. Because when I do my Australian accent, I'm always just doing your accent. And sometimes when I hear other Australians talking, I'm like, oh, that doesn't sound at all like Beth.
That's not Australian because it doesn't sound like Beth.
Like, I'm like, that's a fake accent. And they're like from Sydney or something.
What about you, Ava? Do you feel strongly that you're Canadian?
Not really.
Yeah, it's like you've never really used that.
I think Canadians maybe get offended when people think we're American, but it's not that different than I think being an American either in California or in New York or something. I think probably someone from Toronto and Vancouver, you're probably more similar to someone who's in an urban environment in the U.S. And I think there are probably a lot more differences within Canada and within the U.S. than there are on average between Canada and the U.S., I would assume. So I don't feel super strongly about it. And I think also because Toronto, at least for me when I was growing up, it just felt like such a city of immigrants. And both my parents aren't Canadian. I don't feel a super strong attachment to it other than feeling connected to everyone there because my story was not unique at all. And I don't know if I've said this on the podcast, but when I was younger, I remember thinking that, like, you know, when you grew up, it was like you had to get a job and probably move out of your house. Like, that's, I guess, the vision that people have. But I thought that you also had to move countries because everyone that I knew, their parents had come from another place. And I remember someone telling me, I was like, oh, where is your dad from? And they were like, oh, they're Canadian. And I was like,
what?
I was like, that's not allowed. So I think that made me feel just not super attached to being Canadian because it just was like maybe like a stopover place. And especially now that I haven't lived there in 6 years.
What did you feel when you went to China this year?
Oh my gosh. I think like the racial identity is something that I feel like is like obviously like more directly applicable to this situation. China was a real experience. So I went to China 2 months ago. And when I got there and before I was going, I was super excited. I hadn't been since 2019. And I really was like, okay, I'm excited to be here. And I would love it if I could live here for like a few months or a year. And I stayed for about a month. And by the end, I was super done. I was like, I don't want to come back here. And maybe that could, if this had been in the interview, it would have marked a transformational experience for me because I felt very dehumanized by the entire experience. It had been a long time that I had been in China and that I had been out so much because my mom and I had been traveling. And normally we kind of just stay in my mom's city and we're with our family. And this time we traveled more, so we were like out and about. And yeah, the amount of comments and just people talking about you, but like not really wanting to know you as a person, but just wanting to like categorize you. And I guess people can't see my face, but I'm half Chinese and I'm half white. And I don't look 100% Chinese, obviously. And it was just like every store that I went into, someone was like, oh, are you from Xinjiang or are you from Yunnan, which are provinces where there are like ethnic minorities, like Uyghurs, for instance. I got that all the time. I got, oh, are you in Chinese? The way that you say it is like mixed blood. So people were like, mixed blood? Mixed blood? I mean, it's just the way that it's said. But I still am primarily like Anglophone, I guess. And so that hits the ear in an interesting way. And I think also it was weird to just be like seen as, yeah, less than a person, as like an exotic piece of fruit. Like, and it just got like very tiring. At first it was like a real ego boost because, you know, people were like, wow, like, because everyone is just commenting about your appearance and not only commenting, but like making a judgment on it. So it's like, wow, like you're so beautiful. And like people coming up to you all the time and saying that, which obviously like at first I was like, okay, yes. Cause like, let me tell you, that's probably never happened a single time in the West, like when I'm out and about anywhere, no one's coming up to me and talking to me like that. But by the end, I was so done with it. So I don't really even know how that made me feel, but I think over the years, my relationship with my race, I guess, I just feel like it's changed a lot. And I feel like I had the biggest shift as well when I switched from using my Chinese name to my English name, because I used to go by my Chinese name until I was 18. And when I was younger, and when I went by that name, when I would say it, people were like, it was very clear that I was Chinese. And I saw the biases of how people would treat me thinking that I was Chinese versus how people treated me thinking I was maybe more ambiguous, and like the Ava Ma D'Souza making people think that I was like maybe more like Hispanic or Brazilian or something. So I feel like it's all malleable, and it really, I think that's what like this interview really spoke to me about, was that it's really just about what you make it. Like, it doesn't matter what you are. Obviously, there's discussions that we could have about like transraciality. I'm not making a comment about that or anything, but there's just so many things that sometimes feel like they matter more than what you really are. Because like my experience as someone who's half Asian and half white is so different to someone else, just based on things that are like my name, what my face happens to look like, also language, things like that, and what people perceive you as. Like, it doesn't matter what you think of yourself as sometimes. And so I can definitely see how these types of interviews can also allow someone to measure how someone is feeling with time in a way that quantitative data can't necessarily get at. So I still don't really know where I would fall in that. Maybe we can get Pauline to analyze what I just said.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Ava. That was incredibly profound, and I feel ridiculous about that, my reflection. That was like, I like being Australian in America.
I feel like that wasn't profound at all. And it's like something that I think is weird to talk about too, because I think we say, oh, women should be like, oh, I'm so beautiful and I'm so this and that. But like, we don't really like to hear women say that. Like, the internet doesn't like to hear women say that. But I also feel like it didn't even feel like it was a compliment for me to really take, because I knew that it was about me looking kind of white, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, also, the other thing about being in China, just for anyone if you're ever visiting, and also I was in Korea for a bit and the same thing happened, is people have like no qualms about commenting about your body, like zero qualms. And my mom was like, oh, can she try this on, this shirt or whatever? And in China and in Korea, people were like laughing at the thought that I could try on a certain shirt. They were like, she's so big and fat.
What?
Yeah. No, like, she's so tall and so fat. Like, you're so funny, and that's ridiculous. It was like a child asking to try on like an extra large
suit for giants.
Yeah, or suit for giants. So I'm not saying like I'm like the supermodel of Asia, because I certainly am not, because they were like, you're so big and fat. Like, I can't believe you fit through the door.
Oh, perfect.
It's different cultures, right? You just got to be ready for it. And Beth, if we ever went to China together, people would be taking pictures of you nonstop. I hope you know that. So you might have to have another interview about your identity as an Australian person after you go to China, because maybe that's a transformational experience that everyone needs to have once. Our last question is just what you're working on next that you're excited about and that you can share. I know you've hinted at a few things, including your data with other populations and the quantitative scale, but if there's anything else you want to share.
Yeah, so those are two studies I'm working on right now. And then at Reed, all the faculty need to mentor senior students in research. So all the seniors need to do their own research in order to graduate. So right now I have like four different students under my supervision, and they are interested in racial and ethnic identity. One of them is interested in the bi-directional relationship between socialization and the individual identity. So we can really dig into the different type of socialization messages from different sources and how they all impact the individual, but the individual also impacting the socialization message they're getting. So that bi-directional aspect is really missing in the literature right now, because a lot just focus on how one thing affects the other. And that project, we want to use the preliminary finding from the thesis to submit for a Spencer grant. And once I have the scale for African Americans, I also want to do a study that look into how racial and ethnic identity can moderate the link between discrimination and health. Because the literature on this topic is finding. Some say it moderated, some say it can help buffer, some say it's intensified the impact of discrimination. But I think this new scale can really give insight into, oh, it's the individual is making meaning of the discrimination experience, which can really tell us how the individual is approaching discrimination rather than, oh, because this individual feels strong about their identity, so discrimination is going to impact them more. Really, really focusing more on the individual.
Thank you to Dr. Pauline Ho for joining us this episode.
Our intro and outro music is Nobody Stayed for the DJ by Glacio. Our transition music is Back for More, also by Glacio. Minds Matter is mixed, edited, and created by Beth Fisher, she's the Australian one, and me, Ava Madisouza. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode, but in the meantime, find all our episodes and show notes on mindsmatterpodcast.com.